And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Let's do this thing indeed. Welcome back to episode number 2 of Chatter on Books. Wow, we got another big full room. If I can pop the music down. There we go. Look at that. When it gets humid in here, my hands stick on the control board, and I can't control everything.
Sure, your hands stick on the control board. I don't
too much information.
Yeah.
There you go.
I don't think we need to hear that.
Yes. By the way, something I forgot to do last week. Of course, okay. Tori Clark, David Aldridge, Gina McManus, Michael Kornheiser. I'm Mark Stone.
Cast of thousands out there in Chatter the Restaurant?
Yes. I forgot to say that the music that we were playing comes from a band of littles, Robert Berg, Luke Overbay, and Jason Fuse. The band that they formed is called the Diane Kruger Effect, and that song, which they've granted us permission to use, is called Cosmology. So thank you guys.
Thank you very much. Yes. We love the little bleed over to this show, which is good.
Love it.
Yeah. It's very, very
It's
good.
One universe.
It really is. It really is. So yes, thank you for everybody for listening in last week, and thank you everybody for tuning in again.
Yeah, we've gotten
this week
great comments sent in by email and tweet and fax, and you know, a few drones dropping over our house up the street saying really fascinating focus group with some of the book club ladies who
you
were here last
stop
week.
Listening to focus
Did they think we were not book club enough?
No. I think it was focus liberating. Groups.
Did you have the appropriate whisper?
I didn't. But when Scott Price, who's going to join us later, Scott Price, author of Playing Through the Whistle, Steel, Football in American Town, joins us, I've got to make fun of him for an event he did in Pittsburgh. It was so classic Saturday Night Live book club lady. But the one of the things the book club lady said is they liked it that it wasn't just this very linear dissection of a book.
It was chaotic.
As we say all the time, it was chaotic. 10 o'clock, we were still going. They said it was, as we say all the time, this is not your mother's book club, right? And books are the thread that go through so many other things, and they're just a great jumping off point.
Yes.
So, yeah, they really liked it. I think they felt like they were let out of jail. Right? This is fun.
There's no smiling or laughing. This is book club. This is serious.
That's right. So, Mark, we've got news. Top of the show, we've got news.
Yes, we do.
I think we should go from sad to happy.
Okay, we'll start off with some somber news. The passing in many quarters of a legend, Stan Lee, passed away at age 95, a great comic book artist and author who really brought Marvel Comics into the forefront and made it into the juggernaut that it is today.
And the reading I've done, I kind of knew this before, but when I heard he died this afternoon at 95, life well lived.
It's a good run.
Had a great run.
Nice run.
And peaked late.
Yes.
I like
love that.
About a man.
Yes. Love that.
Yeah.
Way to put the pressure on, Gene.
Good Lord.
But one of the things he did is they said he took comic books and the characters in comic books from being one-dimensional. And I'm looking at Michael, because once we get past one-dimensional, I go, Michael, smart person, talk. from one-dimensional to being complex. Mm-hmm. So the Incredible Hulk had weaknesses and different superheroes had vulnerabilities and actually made it okay. It wasn't just 9-year-old boys that loved these characters, really broadened the scope of people who loved characters.
And he had a cameo. He was a Hitchcock guy. I mean, he was in every single movie.
Sure.
Even like the Lego movies, like the Lego Batman, they had like a Lego character that was
Lego Stanley.
Yeah, you know. And I think I just saw Wreck-It Ralph Wrecks the Internet, and there was a Stan Lee character in like a little, you know, internet version of himself.
Can we stop on why? Why did you see Ralph Wrecks the Internet?
Because I do a movie show. One of the 15 shows that I do. And I saw that because I see everything. I'm going to see, theoretically, if the rain lets up and I get to the movie theater on time, I go see the front runner tonight.
Is it
raining
out?
Yes.
Oh, stunning.
It's been 48 hours.
Shock. Yes. Okay, Michael, you weren't.
It's easy to just criticize the way that the Marvel Universe and comic book movies have entered just our general sense of today.
Through
all these trilogies and one character moves into the next. But if you look at even the difference from when I was a kid and it was Saturday morning cartoons, to what you have now, where you're getting a lot of representation through these stories, and you're seeing these comic book worlds that are really giving that representation to different groups today, and you're seeing how some of these worlds are transforming to fit what we want to see and what we need to see.
Yeah,
I can tell you it's hard to even describe the impact that someone like Stan Lee taking the time to doing Black Panther meant to black people.
Yes.
Right. I can just imagine.
Because
we never saw ourselves in the comic book. Nobody ever did a comic book about us. And so that we are people to be emulated and to be respected and to be admired.
And to have a superhero.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was Anthony Mackie who plays one of Captain America's pals. I forget the name of his superhero, but he, I think, was the first African-American superhero in that sort of universe.
Right.
And he was interviewed. He's like, you have no idea what this means, that I can look down at my son and be, my son can look and be like, you're a superhero, Dad.
Right, exactly.
Because it's like nothing like that happened before.
Well,
so.
I always used to try to imagine a young black woman or girl going to see Star Wars, and here's Princess Leia with cinnamon buns on the side of her head, and that, that's supposed to inspire.
There's nobody that looks like me.
Or every Disney princess that ever was.
Yes.
Sure. And it's the same. And I say this not knowing it, but suspecting it strongly, that it was the exact same reason why Wonder Woman had to be directed by a woman. It had to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because it would have not been as good directed by a man.
Right.
And you go there and you see people in the audience and you go, okay, I get it. Now they see somebody that they can emulate and their kids can emulate and their niece and their, you know, and it's important. And it's important for men to see that too. I get it.
100%.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just very important. So, yeah.
Okay. But God bless them. God bless. I'm fascinated by it went so beyond the comic books, right? To the movies, to
how they franchises.
Absolutely.
And you talk about Peking Lake, Jeannie. I mean, those movies.
Hope Springs Eternal.
Oh my
those
gosh.
Movies have, I mean, we're talking about billions with a B.
Yes.
And they've got three more.
Holding up Hollywood now.
Yeah.
They really are. They've got the Captain Marvel and then the Avengers Infinity War Part 2 and then another Spider-Man movie. That's gonna be another billion-dollar year for those
guys. And he made money, right?
It's
not one of these
did.
Tragic stories. You know the Columbia movies, this woman holding the torch up at the Columbia movies? She died not too long. The woman who was the model for that died not too long ago. And I'm serious. She got paid something like $5 for that.
Oh, my God.
Well, no, she may have died, the original one, but then Annette Bening replaced her.
No.
Like
is that right?
Maybe 10 or 15
I didn't
years
please
know
tell
that.
Me Annette got paid.
Well, I don't know about it. I suspect
I did
Annette
not know
did
that,
get
really.
Paid.
Okay.
But they thought that original model maybe was looking a little too staid. And so they brought in Annette Bening and redid that torch lady with Annette.
Oh, it wasn't Annette and the Grifters, was it? Because that was
Yes.
Okay. From
love that movie.
Whoa.
From sad.
It's the worst ending ever in a movie.
Oh, my God. It was kind of tough. It was kind of tough.
Wow.
Yeah, it didn't end well for a lot of people in that. Yeah.
All right. From sad but life well lived to happy news, we have an announcement of a new book on the scene.
It's her pretending to do
meow.
A drum roll.
Yes. The long-awaited project.
20 years we've been
Simon
working on
the
this.
Sea Cat. It feels like.
Simon the Sea Cat.
Simon the Sea Cat.
Don't forget that
is
name.
Now available on
Yay.
Amazon.
Awesome.
Unfortunately, just as an ebook.
It's okay.
But it's still got all the illustrations.
Yeah.
I'm having some trouble.
Great illustrations.
I'm having some trouble formatting the cover for the paperback. print, but I'm working on that this week.
I'm waiting for the hardcover.
Right. Next week shows the perils of self-publishing.
It's a
bear.
It's a lot harder. And there's like, oh, you're having trouble? Watch this tutorial, which is like in Sanskrit. And you're like, I don't understand any of this. So, but I was finally able to get it on the platform. And so, yeah, Simon the Sea Cat, which is this true story of this cat named Simon, who was found in the streets of, I want to say, Hong Kong in like 1947 by a British sailor, brought him back on board the ship. The ship was called the HMS Amethyst. This is an old true story. And this was during the Chinese Civil War. And the Amethyst job was, you got to go up and check on the consulate up the river. I think it was the Yalu River. And they got caught in a battle with the Chinese communists. And they were, in real life, they were stuck in this battle for like a month or so. And in the course of the battle, Simon the cat was wounded, and his action station, so to speak, was guarding the pantry from and killing rats. Sure. So he was guarding all the food, and he's in the infirmary, and they're going around and like, yeah, I don't think he's gonna make it. And not only did he make it, he sneaks out of the infirmary, and he goes back, and they find him at his action station, inspires the whole crew. They promote him to a member of the crew, so he was actually Able Sea Cat Simon. And there is something in England called the Dickin Medal, the D-I-C-K-I-N, And it's like the Victoria Cross for animals. If animals commit an act of heroism, they get this this medal. And it started after World War One, but in the history of it, dogs, horses, pigeons, because carrier pigeons, all these variant animals get it, and one cat. And that's how I started researching it.
How about that?
And I was like, one cat? And everybody, you know, I was like, I love cats. So I was like, I've got to find out about this guy. And he was, he gets this medal, and, you know, he's a hero amongst his crew members. And it goes back, there's a big, you know, celebration when he gets back to England. And it's...
Is he stuffed somewhere in a museum? Can we go visit, Simon?
Well, the true story...
A little sailor cap on his head.
No, the true story
changes
is that...
Changes uniforms according to the season.
The true story is that when he got back to
England... They ate
him. No, he was... No. That's a different story. That's Simon part two. No, he was in quarantine, and he had something with his wounds, and he passed away shortly after he returned to England. And, of course, the original version of the story I wanted to write was I was going to include that. And then my friend Jim Dyke, he said to me, yeah, and he's a Southern guy. He's like, yeah, you don't have kids, do you, man? No, but this is important life lesson. It's a circle of life. He goes, the cat can't die. The cat cannot die. So so I left it at a very happy moment, but he died. And he has a tombstone, and the entire ship's company came at his funeral. So it's just like, I mean, I tear up when I see
that's
this
awesome.
Stuff.
Nice.
So it's a wonderful story, and what I hope to be the first of a number of stories I read about, true stories about animals that committed all these wonderful acts of heroism, you know, through the course of history.
But I'm with Michael. You got to get the hard copy. Because that, seriously, this is the kind of thing you'd buy for your kids. You'd buy for your grandchildren. Right. You would read with them. Those kind, absolutely.
If I can figure out the paperback, I'll move on to hardcover.
There you go. Get an option.
But yeah, I've got a woman for you. She can help you with this.
I like that.
Yeah.
I just and like that phrase for me in general.
Yeah.
Helps me out. And I do want to thank my illustrator, Miriam Hansen.
Brilliant.
She is just terrific. She's lives in Germany. I've actually never met her.
I was introduced
to her through a friend of mine, and we kind of went back and forth, and I said, this is what I'm looking for, and she did it. She nailed it. Yeah. So I'm very, very excited.
That's great.
Here's what I'd like everyone to do that's listening. Buy the ebook tonight. And then next week when the paperback comes out, go ahead and buy that one, too.
And then the hardback.
Get the whole
for Christmas. Holiday compendium.
All of it.
And if you bring it in here to Chatter, when we're either doing this show or we're doing the Tony show, I will sign it for you.
And you know, you can get a little, print.
Paw print.
Yeah, paw print. So you could, right? Or just get a cat. Say it's Simon. Well. Right, bring it in.
At some point, I'll get another cat. So that, but thank you, thank you. It's been a, it's... It's
10 years?
It's been long? 4 or 5 years, I think.
Liar.
No, it's about 4 or 5 years when I first had the idea. When I first had the idea, and it took me a couple years to write, and it has taken me exceptionally long time to actually bring it to press.
Dog years are 7, how many are cat years?
Cats are bored with us, so I don't think it's more. My God, still?
We're still working on this.
When will you publish a companion soundtrack?
I actually think... You know, and Michael can speak to this because he's much closer to, you know, Walker's not quite there yet. But young people, they don't read that many, hold that many books in their hands. But there is this whole audiovisual kind of experience.
Can I give you a tip when you do the movie version? Have O'Toole come in and say, what have I done? That'll be the end of the movie. It'll be awesome.
Great. What have I done? I was going to, Richard Burton and I were in talks to do the audiobook, but unfortunately passed away 30 years ago. So,
but we can still get him.
Yeah, but I think Nigel might be the voice of the audiobook.
Oh, I think I can predict with certainty this is going to be one of the best-selling books about cats ever.
I love this. I love that you're going to be famous.
I'm not sure that, right?
Awesome.
This is I love your look of Garfield.
Right.
Garfield, get out of here.
Garfield, thank you guys.
Thank you guys.
Thank you. Congratulations. That's a great deal.
Thank you. It's hard.
It's really, really, really hard.
It is.
As somebody who has done 2 books, one sold 6 copies, the other sold 4. Mostly family members.
I've got a copy.
Yeah. And look who's here.
Who's here? Oh my God! Look who's there.
And Scott Price is here. Who's going to roll with us in just a little minute, in a few minutes, to talk about a great book. We got to do 2 things quickly, Scott. But you can join us if you want.
Get a drink.
Get a drink.
Get a drink.
Yeah.
Or
what
two.
Would you like?
No, a real drink.
No, Brian's out there. He can get it for you.
Nice.
Okay, Michael. Would you ask Brian to get Scott whatever he would like? Thank you.
And then come back
because we're doing the best and worst of the bestseller list.
Oh, yeah.
And this week it is that we're doing the Washington Post bestseller list. Mm-hmm. And let's start with fiction. Okay, John Grisham again. who's tired of John Grisham? But I did hear him on the radio last week. He works for 6 months of the year.
I love this.
See, that's the plan I've
right?
got.
That's the Maury Povich model.
I love right?
this. Yeah, Grisham
work for
model.
Yeah, you that's for 6 months, and then you're like, all right. And the other 6 months, you think about it. You're yeah. like, yeah, exactly. I got an idea.
Contemplate your next move.
Mm-hmm. So we got him up there still. And like New York Times, Nicholas Sparks. And mm-hmm. oh, my God. You know, if you've got a teenage daughter, which I used to have, ugh. Nicholas Sparks, is but that, always yes. up there. Yeah. Dreadful.
Weepy.
Don't care about the crawdads singing. Really don't care about them. Jack Reacher.
Jack
Total
Reacher.
Airport.
Reacher.
Another one?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. They're really? All exactly the same. The only one that kind of piqued my interest on this list was The Tattooist of Auschwitz, which I was telling Dave before the show, I have read, and it is... And I think when I read it, I went and did research, and they said, okay, based loosely on some true stories mm-hmm. about a guy. It's the classic whatever. Michael, there's probably some phrase for this, but a guy who he was the one who tattooed people in the concentration camps, and it's how he survived.
That looks mm-hmm. that looks super powerful.
And in the course of surviving by doing this, mm-hmm. he was able to help some people. So right. the rationalization is, yes, it was awful. Yes, he was working with the horrible people who are doing these horrible things. Mm-hmm. But because of his role, he was able to help people. It is pretty remarkable.
And that was 14 last week, and they beat Georgia this week, so that's why they're up to number 10.
Exactly. Yeah.
The big
exactly.
test for this entire list is, can you pick up any of these books at the supermarket?
That's...
Ooh.
Oh, yeah, I got to get...
Ooh, wait, flipping?
Self,
oh, the Mitch Albom book for sure.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah.
Sure. Well, which
this
supermarket?
This is in the checkout.
A Harris Teeter, yes.
Costco. Well, Costco.
They don't have books to check out of the social Safeway, do they?
Refugee we have an Safeway,
we have,
no.
Yeah, we have an aisle.
Do they have aisles in the Refugee Safeway?
No.
They just have stuff lumped
like
in the middle of it.
Like a third world bazaar.
Right? Just grab whatever and run.
I was in the Refugee Safeway today, where I don't go very often anymore.
Why?
I needed dog food.
Oh.
And I could either
hopefully
get...
not cottage cheese.
No, dog food. And I get this particular kind of dog food, and I could either get a literally 3 ounce size package or a 75 pound bag. There's nothing in between.
75 pounds?
Yeah, the inventory there is not
good. How do
you get
that out of the store?
I didn't. I took several of the 3 ounce packages.
About this list, the New York Times has a very interesting column this week inside the list. And they go back and look at what the list was for their bestsellers 25 years ago.
Wow.
And both John Grisham and Stephen King.
Are you
still
kidding?
There
on their list 25 years ago?
Is that right?
Grisham with The Client.
Wow.
Oh, sure.
They
yeah.
didn't okay. say what Stephen King was on for, but those the so client. Those two wow. guys.
And that's one of the big issues with a bestseller list.
Right.
It's not necessarily what you should read next. It's literally just capturing the moment.
Right.
Okay,
right.
But is that wrong? These guys are using wheelbarrows to cart off their money, by the way. God bless them, right?
Yes, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying there are algorithms out there that can help push you into new boundaries, which I think is part of the responsibility of curating lists like this to begin with.
Yeah. We've got to have Mary Madeline on sometime because she actually got into the publishing business herself, but she just goes crazy when you can talk about bestseller lists because she says they're all rigged and you can do this and you can do that, those kinds of things. But I think it's one of my sisters, like a long list, was married to this absolutely dreadful guy. He and I once got... He was dreadful.
That's what you really think.
Awful guy.
Dreadful.
I love this.
Someday we will have Louis Black, the comedian, on because he was the one my sister should have married. Another story. Mark already is looking at the time crap, we're running out of time.
This is the Post story I read.
Yeah, right? But anyhow, she was married to this dreadful guy, and he and I got in this big fight one time because it was in the air. Remember Vivaldi's Four Seasons, that music?
Yes.
Sure.
Yes. My wife
Everybody
loves
Everybody loved it.
Yeah, yeah.
I loved
love
it.
That.
Everybody loved it. And Michael, the most incredible snob of the world, Penn State, said the fact that so many people loved it meant it can't be that good.
Oh.
And that
it's
people,
one of those people,
it wasn't sophisticated enough, etc.
So I'll take Crazy Rich Asians. Big blockbuster movie came out. Fantastic
right.
book, but not necessarily just for content, but for some of the new boundaries it's pushing, which in
yeah.
some ways go back to old models as well. The way that they use footnotes to basically deliver information to you that breaks a lot of the walls that traditionally exist when you are reading and flipping pages
right.
is fantastic. The way
yeah.
it gives a modern critique of consumerism and trying to understand these different cultures, fantastic. But do I recommend that just because it's on this list, it's the 12th best book
right.
that you should read this year, this month? No.
But what do you do? Do you ask
you
friends?
Do
you?
If I were an aspiring writer, I would take this list and I would
Mark.
Do a mashup. I would say, I would write a book about a decorated World War II hero who attempts to figure out the killer of a 15-year-old runaway. Right.
And returns to North Carolina.
And returns to North Carolina to help sell her family cottage.
To the sand hills.
Good to go.
Right.
I'm going to go home tonight and start it.
Right.
Why is North Carolina always the home of so many of these?
The bridges of Madison County. Right. And
but I will say this. I really love the movie Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah.
Did not think I would.
I didn't see it. Everybody said it's good.
I'm telling you, David. I went in there and I was like, there is zero chance I will enjoy this movie. And I think 5 minutes into it, you could hear me audibly like, are you kidding me? I love this movie. It was utterly delightful. Visually, it's stunning. All the performances, they capture you. And so I don't
read the book. You'll finish it in a weekend and it'll make you laugh out loud.
Okay, so that was going to be my next question. Okay. So you've read it and that's something I should,
It's a little edgy.
There you go.
It's quite edgy and interesting. I read a lot of stories about both the book and the movie. Asians like the book better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The one they think it's very accurate. And the guy who writes the book knows what he's talking about, what life is like there. And it was a little edgier and they liked it better.
Well, there's a great line, Kim Jong, they have a family over there and they're all eating and these kids don't want to eat their chicken nuggets. He goes, hey, come on, there's kids starving over there in Alabama. You've got to eat your food. Something like that. It's very funny.
Yeah, it's funny.
Okay, kids, switch to nonfiction pretty quickly. Again, this is the Washington Post bestseller list.
Now, I'm
go
telling
Jeannie.
You.
Oh, yeah,
go,
the medical medium liver rescue.
This is the lead story.
That's all you need to know.
The number one book is about your liver.
Yep.
I'm
not going to read that.
Who is going to read this book?
Tony Kornheiser.
And sit here and have a glass of wine. I ask you.
The liver.
I just cannot imagine discovering the specifics.
Yeah.
Medical Medium Liver Rescue, a deep dive into the essential role the liver plays in our overall
Stop
health.
On liver.
End now, of story.
To Michael's point, the movie was much different.
Yeah.
And I think you have to see that to get the full
picture.
Had
that timer guy, I think. I loved that when I was a kid. It's awesome. It's about your liver. I loved that guy. Awesome.
Mark, you got Tucker's Hanging On.
Yes.
Number 7 on this
Ship
list.
Ship of Fools.
Yep.
Which, by the way, I think one of the reasons why he wrote that title is because it's also the name of a Grateful Dead song, and Tucker is a big fan of the Grateful Dead song.
Well, that'll work.
I'm hoping that there's a tie-in there.
And a great Catherine Porter novel.
Yeah.
As well.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
And
a wonderful movie with Lee Marvin and others in it. Yeah.
Okay, number 12, The Mamba Mentality. Kobe Bryant reveals his approach to becoming mentally and physically stronger. Moving on.
I'm not taking any life
who's
lessons.
This kid Bobby Woodward? Has he done anything?
Nothing.
Here's the deal.
Hold
Kobe.
Up. I will read the Joanna Gaines cookbook.
I
love that couple.
Kobe, is great that player, worked really hard, doesn't need to write a book.
I will tell you that Ina Garten, who has number 3 with Cook Like a Pro.
Do you like her?
She is a lovely woman. I've met her a couple of times.
She was a State Department gal.
I thought it was economic advisor.
Yeah.
What's
the
but anyway.
Tomato, tomato.
She has got it figured out.
How easy is
she
that?
Just.
Yeah.
It's not easy. Oh, yeah. Well.
That's one of her lines.
That's
right.
That's what she says. And it is.
But she keeps figuring out a way to do the next cookbook.
Right.
It
and
always works.
I have friends who actually know her very, very well, and they say she is genuinely always surprised. Like, you know, like we all think somebody's going to find out we're complete and total frauds.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right here.
Hands up, everybody.
Right here. Of course.
Everybody. Yep. Scott Price back there.
Yes.
Get ready. She always thinks people are just going to go, what are you doing? You're out here telling
people
how to cook these
Lawson's
things.
I like Nigella Lawson's books.
Yeah.
But for a different reason.
Yeah. Okay. But look at number 15, Good Morning, Good Night, the Lin-Manuel Miranda thing. Have you guys seen this?
No.
This is going to take off again. I love him to death. He created the most brilliant things in the world. But this started out as just what he did on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of little morning, when he was over in London getting ready to do the show over there. Just little morning affirmations. I don't like that word, but anyways, people love them.
Just sort of positivity in your life, right?
Positivity in my life.
Nothing
but from
Lin-Manuel
Miranda.
I can understand him having that point of view.
But I think that one is going
out well.
I love it because that comes in at 15, and the book at 14, which I will not say, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Blank by Mark Manson, a blogger counters the positive attitude of self-help books.
Exactly.
So like they're going straight head-to-head on that.
There you go.
But I'm going to root for Lin-Manuel Miranda.
I am too.
Me too.
Genius.
Yeah,
total
genius.
We might as well rip this list up with what's coming out tomorrow.
Which is Simon the Sea Cat.
Well, in addition to Simon the Sea Cat, we have a memoir by a certain former First Lady.
Michelle Obama.
Yeah.
That's
I think that might be.
Is that going to top the liver book, you think?
Oh, that'll be tough.
I don't know.
No, I'm glad you mentioned that. And maybe because I'm I've lived in this town too long. But sometimes when books like that come out, you hear so much about them. You read so many excerpts. You hear everybody analyze it and just dissect it to pieces. Right. You feel like, oh, I don't need to read it.
Right.
Right? Donna Brazile is going to be with us next week. And hers is exactly the kind of book normally I would have just... I read it and I listened to it in the car this weekend going to and from Raleigh. Everyone should read that book.
Why?
She puts you in the room.
Okay.
She puts you in the room where it happens, and it is just stunning.
Like Game Change?
Better. Better. Because those guys, I know all those guys. It's all about them. It's all about them.
See, oddly enough, after hearing her interviews and seeing the format of the book in the three-part process, I'm more interested to see Michelle Obama as the student who's giving me a historical breakdown of the socioeconomic changes in Chicago than I am to get the inside personal stories of becoming a mother and the early years in office.
I agree completely. What they went through as a young couple and knowing what they wanted to do, but knowing what how hard it was going to be, I agree.
I just can't. I mean, I'm always continue to be fascinated by the arc of people's lives and how someone in 12 years can go from first year law student or I just graduated from law school and I'm making, what, I know, $40,000 a year to president of the United States and first lady. How does that happen?
Windows of opportunity can be very narrow things.
Oh, my God. That's just amazing to me.
I think we should get Michelle on the show. What do you say?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Who
Done.
Do we know?
That's a good idea.
Okay, Scott's getting nervous because he's got like a hot date at 7.
So. Hot date.
Scott Price, but come
Scott
on
Price,
down.
Scott Price, come on down.
You're the next contestant.
Do we have time to do, because my Marine friends will be very upset. Can we do the Marine thing very quickly?
Sure, yes.
Okay. It's your show.
Yeah.
It's
well,
your
it's not
show.
Really. It's not really. Do we have a little music?
If we have Marine music?
If it'll play. Hold on.
So it was the Marines' birthday on November 10th. Happy birthday, Marines. Today is Veterans Day.
Yes.
Thank you, everybody who served.
Yes, thank
you. Yes,
and we
very
won't get
much
and
so.
We will not get sued for using this music.
No, it is in the public domain, but let me just say that this is the oldest of official song in the United States Armed Forces.
God bless them.
I see the lyrics were from 1942. The music by Jacques Offenbach is from 1867. Wow. It was adopted in 1929. They kind of So I think they changed some lyrics in the Second World War to fully update it. But yeah, it's the Marine Corps hymn.
It's the Marine Corps. Yeah. I've always
Halls of Montezuma.
I love everybody in the military. I've always loved the Marines the best because they had to try harder. Smaller, right? They just had to try harder, and they always had to try to get past it.
This speech, so, you gotta take it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think it was Jamie McIntyre
with
last
with slingshot.
Go ahead. Yeah, and there's guns for thousands of miles trained on you. Good luck.
Good luck. By the way, I was watching a little bit of the Pacific yesterday, where they have John Bassalone, the hero was it the Philippines? I guess he was the Philippines, and he won the Medal of Honor. And if you haven't seen the Pacific, just see that portrayal of him. It's just, I mean, he was as brave. Had the Medal of Honor, could have gone on the banquet circuit for the rest of the war and said, no, I want to go back, and went back and was killed at Iwo Jima.
Yeah. You know, we could
just
save
the bravest man ever.
Your ridiculous schedule, Mark, by doing the movie show and the book show at the same time.
I could do that.
We need a bigger table.
Yes.
We're going to need a bigger table.
What we're referring to is the Marine Corps University Research Library and the reading list.
Which is infamous.
On that.
Yes.
Which was fascinating.
So you've not, so I've known about this for some time, and the services all have reading lists and the Army War College on that, but the Marines is pretty infamous for many reasons. But what was so fascinating?
The broad spectrum of reading, that there was fiction, Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman, that there
was phenomenal,
specific how to navigate the Pentagon, how to deal with bureaucracy, which I think is a book a lot of us could read in management in any corporation that you're...
How about the Federalist Papers, too?
Yes, the Federalist Papers.
Wasn't that great?
Yeah.
What about those?
Yeah. And I'm telling you, the book I really want to read is the H.R. McMaster book, Dereliction of Duty.
Yeah.
About how LBJ and others deceived the Joint Chiefs.
Absolutely. Where the politicians completely took over. Yeah, completely abdicated responsibility in one sense, right? Another one, guy we should have some time, is Mattis, who's the current Secretary of Defense. With this administration, you always say the current Secretary of
Right, because that could change.
So today,
could change by the time
Monday,
we post the show.
Right.
Yeah.
But a Marine, just an absolutely obsessive reader, has been for years and years and years and years. And he says all the time, nothing has happened that hasn't happened before.
I hope
and if
he's
you
right.
read a lot, right? And it is it's a massive part of his inspiration, his motivation every
single
day.
The good news that I got from this reading list was that the whole idea of going to war takes a long time and it's very hard, and you really need to think about it before you decide.
And you should think twice and three times and four times.
Yeah.
We couldn't go through the the stuff we had on top was for the most senior officers. And if you go to the last page of your handouts, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, it's Simon. Look at that.
It's Simon. You go back to the last page, it talks about what the most recent recruits read. And it's things like Red Badge of Courage. Because they want these young men and women to know. It's scary stuff.
Yeah,
when you actually get out there, it might seem all romantic when you're at the recruiting station, but it is scary, scary stuff. And the most recent recruits get the how awful war can be physically, mentally, emotionally. And then the most senior get, this is a ton of stuff to manage, and you better know what the bleep you're doing.
It's a great balance to see that with the landmark Thucydides and trying to put some of this in perspective with the idea of history repeating itself.
Yeah.
And not necessarily having the sense as to where every recruit or officer is coming from with his or her educational background, because that's something they might be seeing for the first time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't Mattis the guy that like goes, even when he's in combat, he has like a copy of Marcus Aurelius in his back pocket?
On a t-shirt. Wears it on the t-shirt.
Really?
At all times, yeah. Yeah.
Love that. Love that.
Okay.
So thank you, everyone in the Corps.
Yeah, thank you, everybody. Thank you for everybody for
past
serving.
Past, present, future.
Happy Veterans Day.
Happy Veterans Day.
So are we allowed to have music to cue in our wonderful guest,
yes.
Scott Price?
Scott, why don't you walk on
Scott,
over?
Scott, come on down.
Come on down. We got some Pittsburghian type music, right?
Oh. Here. Let's see if he recognizes it. Where are we going to put him?
He's here. Where do you want me?
Are you going to move by me?
Yeah.
Than a I'm crossing you in style someday.
This, of course, is Moon River, written by Harry Mancini.
Oh, that's correct.
And sung by a woman I wish I had a drink with at some point, Audrey Hepburn, who is just the best.
Wow.
And this is from the movie Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yeah, a little movie I like to call Breakfast at Tiffany's.
And you're probably wondering why playing this music.
Why, Gene?
And we'll ask
Scott will tell us.
We'll ask Scott. Scott Price, Sports Illustrated, world traveler, one of the few people to play one-on-one basketball with Barack Obama. Author of this absolutely fabulous, my favorite book ever, Playing Through the Whistle, Steel Football in American Town. I might be a little biased geographically, but why are we playing this music?
Because Henry Mancini is one of the unbelievably talented people who came from Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, which is the hub of Western Pennsylvania, the real dominant power of Western Pennsylvania high school football, produced Mike Ditka, Darrell Revis, Ty Law, Pete Maravich played basketball there.
Who's he?
And Henry Mancini, who won 4 Academy Awards and 20, you know, other Grammys, and lived next door to Joe Letteri, who has won 4 Academy Awards for unbelievable visual effects for Lord of the Rings and movies like that. So this place is an incredibly special town, and I dove into it. And by the way, I just want to say my dad was a Marine, so I didn't hear the Halls of Montezuma, but I was talking to my son earlier today, and my grandfather actually was gassed at in World War I.
Wow.
Army and won 2 Purple Hearts, or one was awarded 2 Purple Hearts. Became an alcoholic, and actually, it shattered him for many, many years. So it was brutal. But literally 100 years ago, today essentially, or yesterday.
11.
So, so I was reflecting on that today. Anyway, so besides that, that's me, and that's.
I know the answer to this question. Why Aliquippa?
Well, I mean,
what got you there? And where did you stay, by the way?
I didn't stay
across the river from where I grew up.
Yeah.
I know Aliquippa.
Did you grow up in Ambridge?
Yeah, right down the road from Ambridge.
Harmony?
Ambridge is where I got in trouble and had to drive my father home from Matt Anthony Wayne's that night when I was 11 years old. he was overserved. Yeah. where did you stay in Aliquippa?
And why is Matt Anthony Wayne? Why was the place called Matt Anthony Wayne's? Because Matt Anthony Wayne, the great general.
There.
No, he went through there, and because all his army was sneaking away from camp to go to the whorehouse in Aliquippa, he legendarily sent a cannonball across the river and blew up the whorehouse.
So, the mighty Ohio.
Yeah. So maybe that's where the name Mad Anthony came from.
Maybe. Where did you stay when you were doing all this work?
I stayed in Moon. There was no hotel in Aliquippa.
Out by the airport.
Out by the airport. So I went back and forth. And basically, I went up there in 2010 for Sports Illustrated. An editor at SI, his family was from Aliquippa High School, and he said, look, there's a high school that produces all this talent. They're still winning. They're a Class A school competing right now, Class AAA, and they continually win WPIL titles. They're still the most dominant force in Western PA in their class and beyond. And, you know, meanwhile, the steel mill collapsed in the 80s, like steel mills all over the place. And I ended up writing a sports story about, well, here's this place that had all these incredible, you know, talents that you know from. And here's how they're still achieving and competing in the midst of...
Despite what had happened.
Despite everything. Yeah. And it's still happening. I mean, it's moving in real time. And winning.
Yeah.
And still producing Division I talent. And, mm-hmm. and Revis was the last of the ones that, you know, sort of claimed superstardom. But at the time, a guy named Jonathan Baldwin had been drafted by the Chiefs in mm-hmm. first round. So he was the last one. Washed out after a year or two there. But and then I wrote my longest piece I had ever written for Sports Illustrated. And it was 10,000 words. And it was one of only two times in which I thought there's too much here to write about, because what I didn't get into was the achievements. I mean, not only the people I listed, but Jesse Steinfeld, the Surgeon General, who was fired by Nixon because of his opposition to tobacco. You know, there are other, Henry Mancini, and also the Wagner Act, which essentially established unions in America. The Supreme Court was the test case for the Wagner Act. When the Supreme Court approved it or endorsed it, was the Aliquippa 10 and a bunch of guys who were arrested and for union activity. And the last thing is that everything that has happened in Western Pennsylvania, there are plenty of football towns like Aliquippa, but everything that happened, the collapse of the steel mill, the rise of crack cocaine, the labor battles of the 30s, all sort of happened there in extremely dramatic terms. You know, there's always drugs but in Aliquippa it was a nonstop nightmare. And meanwhile, the football was sort of tied inexorably in with it. I mean, Tony Dorsett's nephew was running the biggest crack ring in town. The now current coach of Aliquippa High busted that crack ring as a cop. I mean, his defensive coordinator was involved in the investigation. There are 15 incredible, and the number shifts, but the assistant coaches are all involved in law enforcement, or most of them, and so often are involved in arresting or booking or whatever the relatives of the players involved at times, and so it's and meanwhile the, you know, race was always a problem in America. It obviously has been, and in the 60s and 70s it reached a fever pitch. It was tension everywhere, but in Aliquippa there were race riots.
Tell me if I got this wrong, but in the 80s, again, I had moved down here by then, but in the 80s. The racial tension was so high that for the football team, very successful football team, at the end of the season, there was an end-of-the-season banquet for the white players and an end-of-the-season banquet for the black players in the 80s.
Yeah.
Right?
And essentially, Don Yanessa, one of the three sort of titanic figures of coaches, basically gave up. He just couldn't take it anymore. The team was split, just like the town. You'd have white players sit on one side of the gym at the beginning of the season, and blacks on the other side. And it was he finally said, "You guys, if you guys want to do it, you're going to be ruined by this if you don't fix it. And I can't do it. You have to do it." And Peep Short, that defensive coordinator, was one of the people who got together with white players, gathered the players, and said, "We're going to fix this, and if you can't play with black players or white players, whatever, you're out of here, and we're not going to hear the N-word, we're not going to hear the honky word, we're not going to hear anything." And as a result, because of the football team, and again, this isn't a kumbaya story because the harshness remains, mm-hmm. and crack was tearing families apart, but as a result of that, they dissolved those individual banquets, and they started coming together. Charlie Lay, a very well-regarded black steelworker in town, was one of the hidden hands behind this, working with Yanessa. And eventually they had the dinner would come came together, and the town really became united behind behind the team.
Can you talk about the cheerleaders?
Yeah, in the early 60s, I mean, essentially, there were no black cheerleaders on the team, and it was it was a real rift, you know, and a real problem in the town among the black players and among the black community.
And some of the players took a stand.
Yeah, and even that is a matter of sort of
debate.
Well, it's not a debate, but it, Robert Pipkin, it was a basketball player who sort of went on the team almost on a lark, and at the time, and he was a far better basketball player. He went off and played basketball in Idaho, and so he came on, and he was known as, quote unquote, in the words of the day, an agitator, and he did come in and say, well, you know, I'm not, and he organized a boycott and got players to get behind it. But some in the black community, including the other players, were like, I'm not going to join the boycott because I need to get a college education, and you have nothing at stake here. You still have basketball. And he did. So so some sort of suspected his motives or thought he wasn't really putting as much in the game as they were. But it did eventually provoke change and did help what was a really dicey issue in town, even though it's not as sexy or as dramatic as the race riots. It really spoke to, let's get right down to it. I mean, essentially by not having black cheerleaders be allowed to be the face of your high school team, which was the face of the town, you're essentially saying you're not good looking enough. You're not good enough to be representative of who we want to be and who we are. And he deserves all credit for that. But to this day, Robert Pipkin is sort of a debatable figure in Aloha Balor.
It comes through in the book.
Yeah.
So, Jeannie, you and I were talking before the show about the level of detail in this.
I'll
set you up by this. Again, I've read the book twice. I listened to it, which is a great thing to do. And I don't know how you research so much. You not only learned about the rise and fall of the steel industry, but about how Bessemer furnaces work.
Yeah.
And what happened with the labor unions. And Gary Grandstaff, by the way, has a relative who worked for my dad.
Oh, is that right?
I remember when Gary got laid off.
Yeah.
Football, basketball,
how
race riots.
How the town was laid out.
Right.
The specifics of the
plan
real
11,
estate.
Plan 12. But you have...
But I'm fascinated by the mechanics of your reporting, and the one... I just wrote one thing down that really struck me as sort of the epitome of it. When Yanessa leaves Detroit to come for the interview, you note that he paid $40 for a round-trip ticket on Northwest Orient Airlines.
That's right.
Now, that was how many years ago? And you found that detail? Did Yanessa tell you?
Of course. No. David will understand. I mean, Yanessa is, you have to understand, okay, and the movie All the Right Moves, a lot of people in Aliquippa will tell you it's based on Aliquippa, and a lot of that is because of Don Yanessa, who is one of the great circus acts in high school football, one of the great talkers. He could charm the birds out of the trees. I mean, he was unbelievable, and he loved to talk. And so Don Yanessa also prided himself on having, as he called it, a photographic memory. Now I will say that in doing my research, when I would cross check things every once in a while, he got a score wrong, but overall he was pretty dead on, and he did indeed say to me both what he paid and the airline, and I do love that he said Northwest Orient because
who knows
exactly.
Northwest Orient,
right.
The other thing that struck me is when you hear pro football players interviewed today, they often say, well, you know, it was my single mother, it was my parents, or it was my coach who determined my fate, that kept me on one side of the track versus the crack cocaine, the crime. Nowhere in this book is mentioned what many pro football players say today, the church, religion.
Yeah.
Was there any role at all in Aliquippa?
Boy, that's a great point. I mean, no, And I don't mean that they didn't go to church, and right. I don't mean that they weren't devout, and I don't mean that you didn't hear that. But look, the forces that tore this town apart were profound, deep, and horrifying.
Yes.
I mean, it wasn't just the end of the steel mill. One of the enduring things to me about this is just the importance of work for men specifically. Mm-hmm. I know that, you know, we're not supposed to, like, at this point say there's a difference, but I think this vestige, especially with that generation and the generations before, the loss of a job is hollowing. It destroys. There's
yeah.
a dignity. Mm-hmm. This is what I do. Men define themselves, and I would say classically, those men especially, but it adheres to me, and I'm the son of a Depression-era kid. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you do? What do you do every day?
Sure.
What do you do? And it really matters. And when that is taken away, it really is a source of identity and strength and pride. And when a family is shattered by that, because like everybody says, when mom's not happy, nobody's happy. It's true, but when dad's not happy, it doesn't help. And
right.
and I will tell you that it cut out the core of manhood in that town, and of course destroyed the women who had to pick up the pieces around it. And I think religion was sort of revealed in some ways as helpless. It didn't help because essentially right after that, everybody, I mean, and this is the other thing that is, you know, not politic, but the fact is that there were people, so many guys who never had been arrested, for certainly for hitting their wives or anything, but all of a sudden domestic violence spiked in the wake of the end of the steel mill. And this was the largest integrated steel mill in the country and one in the world, 7.5 miles along the Ohio River.
Just stop on that for a second. The mill was 7.5 miles
yes.
long.
Yeah, and yeah. It was the fact of life. I mean, it was, look, at its height, Aliquippa was 30,000 people and essentially, you know, had a workforce of up to 14, 15,000. So everybody in town was affected by it in one way or another. And it when it was gone, it tore the heart out of the place. Yeah. And then in the vacuum of no work, the crack epidemic sure. picks up essentially at the same time. And by the way, this is you know, a common story. And in Baltimore, it was the same story writ large. I mean, you know, so steel mill goes down and crack swoops in. And there were many men who had never been arrested for any kind of crime were suddenly dealing because they got to bring home money. I mean, when it comes right down to it, the kids need food. And it's very easy for me to hear the word drug dealer and, you know, be instantly condemnatory, you know, about it. And frankly, once you realize the context,
survival,
the desperation yeah. involved is heartrending.
Mm-hmm.
And so to answer your question, in the face of a loss of work and then the dispiriting destruction of souls, essentially through crack, I mean, there, you know, Ty Law, you know, was essentially telling me, you know, at one point, you know, his mother was a crack addict.
I remember.
And he was saying, you know, at one point it hit me like some woman came on to him as a teenager, you know, I'll do anything for you if you give me some money or crack. And he thought, is my mother doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And just think about what that does to, I mean, a kid. I mean, it is horrendous. And frankly, as a born and raised Catholic, there ain't nothing in that message unless you're somebody far deeper and more profound than I am, that seems like it can hold up against that assault.
It is. Obviously, you're a modest guy, but you and I talked a few weeks ago about this, and I think this book, Playing Through the Whistle, is what a lot of people said Hillbilly Elegy was,
mm-hmm.
right? Hillbilly Elegy was held up by some pretty superficial people, I think, as this explains it, right? This explains why people turned to Donald Trump. This explains it, and it really didn't. This does, in very real, very compelling, very factual detail. So this is why people turn to these things. This is why people are turned off. This is why people are resentful and angry. It really, really speaks to it. And I'm just wondering, because you spent so much time there, obviously, and you've gone back many times,
yeah.
right? You've gone back many times since then. How have people in the area responded to it? Do they appreciate the honesty of it?
The watchword of Aliquippa, Mike Zmianek, the recently, you know, deposed coach who's off coaching Joe Montana's old high school now, once said to me, he said, first of all, he said, here in Aliquippa, you know, we don't stab you in the back. We turn you around and stab you in the chest so you can see us coming. Yeah. I mean, there is, I can swear, there's little. I mean, I've never been to a place, certainly in this country, where the lack of spin and is more pronounced.
Yeah.
I mean, because everybody knows everybody's story in such a small town, and everybody's story has, they've got somebody in jail. There's somebody in their family. They lost the house. They lost the job. There's no pretense because everybody knows. And what everybody kept telling me was, overall, was tell it straight. Tell the truth. What's going on here. Mm-hmm. And my whole thing was, look, this town is important. This town, to me, spoke a lot in microcosm for what's going on in the country over the last 100 years.
Well, on the one hand, you have Mike Ditka, you have Darrell Rivas, you have Ty Law, and then you have these guys, and you tell about what their high school careers were like, and they try to make it in the pros, they try to make it,
right.
And they come back.
Yeah.
And that is so parallel to the city itself.
They have nothing to come back to.
Right.
And yet they do keep coming back because Drayvon Henry, who's playing now at West Virginia, told me, you know, I mean, you look in the town, and it does, as one GM told me from, basically it looks like a bomb went off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's like, every time I leave the town, my stomach hurts. And until I get back, I mean, because there's something about the pain, I believe, that mm-hmm. has, that I mean, it's life at the extreme.
Existential.
And they feel it, but they can't leave it behind. Mm-hmm. I mean, Rivas, sure. You know, was like 2 years ago in a street fight in Pittsburgh with some of his boys from Aliquippa. Mm-hmm. And you're thinking, well, Darrell, don't you know enough to, but you can't leave that behind. You know,
Tony Dorsett, who wasn't really Aliquippa, Hopewell. But
well, it's a very funny thing. Absolutely. You know, he went to Hopewell, which is the rival school, 3 miles away. I think I actually measured it. And Dorsett, but he grew up in Black Aliquippa. His father was.
And he wanted to come back.
And he desperately wanted to come back.
Yeah.
But to your point about, I didn't go there to write about Trump or to write, I didn't know anything about it. I was there starting in 2009, 2010, and then through 2016, but I will tell you that I felt it. I was surprised the day of the election, like everybody else. But I, a month before, was like, he's going to win.
Yeah, you were less surprised.
I was less surprised, but I was predicting it. I didn't believe it because it seemed so cartoonish. Mm-hmm. But I absolutely was predicting it because. And by the way, this is a town of white flight. I mean, it used to be. I mean, and so Aliquippa itself went Democratic and for Obama and for Hillary. It was one of the three towns in Beaver County. But Beaver County used to be staunchly Democratic. And over, the feeling I got was, we built you. We built you, Democratic Party. We are what your backbone was, and you're slapping us in the face. You're ignoring us completely. And people want respect, mm-hmm. and they want respect in that area as much as any other walk of life. And they rebelled against that in Beaver County. And it's going to be a long road back for the Democratic Party.
What's next after this? Can you do another book? Can you throw
for me?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm off doing another book. I am. Yeah.
You get the bug, don't you?
I am. But I had to go in a completely different direction. Yeah. So I'm actually doing a book about lacrosse.
All right.
Believe it or not, which is
there's a certain hatred in this particular environment. I'll just warn you.
I understand it. Well, I mean, we're in Northwest D.C. lacrosse country. But you know, from the Native Americans to Wall Street to the rise of women, and the blue collar kids on Sons of Cops and firefighters and the idea that more than any other sport, lacrosse lost more people in 9/11 than anyone else because of all the guys working in finance.
Yeah. So
wasn't Jim Brown like the greatest lacrosse player ever?
The greatest.
Yes.
Like legitimately,
yes.
Right?
No, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely he was the greatest. And I
You've heard Dick Schaap talk about this.
No.
Dick Schaap was at Columbia, is that correct? He was the goalie at Columbia. And they played Syracuse and he said, this guy came out and scored like nine goals in the game. It's the greatest player I ever saw.
He was Jim Brown, and he learned it on Long Island. And some people believe that he actually loved lacrosse. That certain lacrosse people will tell you this. But in I did a long piece on the Iroquois, who are fascinating because they are the opposite of what we think of when it comes to prep school lacrosse. They live on reservations, mm-hmm. and they are the third best team in the world and the only indigenous nation that competes as a
wow.
team. And
wow.
they came in third, this past summer again. And it's legendary that up at, because he went up there one time because he went to Syracuse
yeah.
and Onondaga is right near there. And it's legendary up there that the one time Jim Brown ever left his feet was when this guy in Onondaga plowed into him. And that guy is still a hero
sure.
in Onondaga. Yeah,
good reason.
He took
yeah.
out Jim Brown.
Yeah.
So I'm working on that now.
This will be the opening for a big conversation about lacrosse in this studio.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so I was sharing...
Not today.
I was sharing details of this book, Playing Through the Whistle, with some of the book club ladies in my crowd, and got a few of them to read it. And because what I said to them was, you don't have to like football. You don't have to like...
That's
you can
right.
hate Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah.
It's so much about life. And
about
just God bless you for yeah. doing this and putting so much into it. I think it's a really, really... important book, so I hope three more people read it after listening to this podcast.
That's all I ask. Listen, I'll come over and read it to you. Anybody buys it, I'm over. I'm there. I'll read you to sleep.
Okay, don't leave. We've got one thing we need to do with the group quickly, and we'll ask you to do it too. But Mark, I'm going to give you your chair back.
Oh, you're going
to
give me my chair back? Okay.
Yeah.
How about that? I can fill here for a second. That what an amazing story.
No, it's all.
You know, and I grew up.
Work.
You know, through
work is everything.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I know how many people identify themselves.
Talk
and I grew up. In like the New England, so like through like Fall River and
right.
all those areas,
yeah,
you saw the same thing where
absolutely.
Like just cities of industry
yeah.
completely gone.
Yes.
And it just removes the identity of those towns. And whether it was crack or whether there's heroin, all these, you know, New Bedford, which was once
right.
yeah. like the
yeah.
commerce capital of America, is now just rife with yeah. all these troubles.
And this is why this is again why I keep telling people do not understand who aren't from D.C., they do not understand. How important Marion Barry was to this city.
Right.
And they make fun of him because he got hooked on crack right. cocaine and he's a joke nationally, and I get that.
But he was important.
He gave Absolutely. Me my first job.
Yeah.
And he gave
he,
every kid
yeah.
I
and
knew
he understood that.
His first job.
Yeah, he understood that about putting people to work.
Yeah, and that means everything. My dad's 90, and I talked to him today, and the first thing he talked about was how he took the train back and forth for 12 years. He was a porter on a train because
yeah.
it was work.
Yeah.
And he said, I always had a job. And everybody I knew that I grew up on my block, I didn't know anything about their parents, but I
right.
knew what they did.
Mm.
And
yeah.
that changed. That saved me. It saved my brother, my
yeah.
sister, and everybody on that block.
Because
mm-hmm. we were on a block where everybody worked.
Right.
And you were supposed to work. And
yeah.
it wasn't like a weird thing that you worked. You were supposed to have a job. You were supposed to go earn a living for your family. And the fact that I was fortunate enough to grow up in Washington, D.C., where the federal government was...
Yeah.
Which meant you could go get a job tomorrow if you needed to go get a job. It saved so many kids growing up in the 70s and 80s who didn't get seduced by that dark side because they didn't have to be.
Right.
And it changed everything. That's why, and to your point, the work is everything.
Mayor for Life, right? The documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no, he's Marion Barry is an absolutely pivotal and misunderstood as well as understood.
Understood.
No, but
completely understood. But
the interesting thing is that he ended up being a national punchline.
Yeah.
But it is the tragedy is how important and how loyal he was
yeah.
to his part of town forever.
Well,
that
people
board,
don't
I mean,
understand. I mean, they keep saying, well, why would they reelect him time
yeah.
after he was arrested?
I know.
That's why.
Right. And it's a shame because it all gets sort of swept under and
yeah.
only the headlines remain,
right.
yeah.
you know, of him getting arrested and all those
but
kind of things.
But especially nationwide.
Like, oh, yeah, especially
the farther
nationwide.
You get from D.C.,
oh, yeah,
by the time you get to the West Coast, all you hear is bitch set me up.
Yeah.
You know,
and
yeah.
It's no different. It was no different here than Tammany Hall or
right.
any of the other places where they
right.
had patronage. It's the yeah. same thing.
Right.
Yes.
That's why they keep getting reelected.
He got them jobs. Yeah.
Got them jobs.
So, yeah. Put food on the table.
Yeah.
What an important story. Scott,
absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming in and more importantly for writing it.
Thank you for having me so much. I mean, the book is oddly important. My family is so sick of it because I was constantly saying, Sarah, for 6 years, I'm like, you know who's from Aliquippa? I mean, it just went on and on.
Hey, funny story about Aliquippa kids.
I mean, seriously, let me tell you about Henry Mancini. They're like, no, please.
Moon River.
Oh, man.
All right.
So, quick recommendations.
Oh, recommendations. Yes, we're okay. So we're on the desert island. You get one book.
Yeah.
Which book is it? We're going to lead off with you, Michael.
Well, this is not one book I would take with me on a desert island, but one book I'm reading right now, Boomer One. I did not want to read this because it's a critique of millennial culture. Oh. We have a dissatisfied youth who wants to have a traditional job in journalism, ends up losing his job, loses the girl, has to move back in with his parents, and he takes on the name Boomer One to try and take out his parents' generation who are taking all of the jobs.
Wow. Wow. Who wrote that?
This is Daniel Torday.
Daniel Torday, Boomer One. All right, Jeannie?
Well, this is a book, I'm going to be serious here, I'm sorry. This is a book I read a while ago, but it keeps coming back to me. I keep thinking about it. And it is Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
Mm-hmm.
And it is about a Nigerian woman who comes to the United States to get her education. She leaves the military dictatorship of her country. And she, in time, begins to write a blog about, as a non-American black, and just reading her blog entries in this novel shed so much light, not just on white American culture, but on black American mm-hmm. culture and the life of an immigrant in this country and how she tries to, at first, become an American and then salvage her Nigerian culture mm-hmm. and personality. And it is a really compelling story about the immigrant experience, not just in America, but other places. And
what's
as
it
well.
Called again?
Americana.
Americana. I like that. David?
I am in love with a book that I've read for years called And So It Goes. It's Linda Ellerbee's autobiography, and it is just fascinating because she's such a great writer. She is so funny, and she is so, and she tells these just story after story about going into network news in the 1970s and what that was like for a woman.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
How crazy that was, and doing Overnight, which is like one of my all-time favorite shows that nobody remembers now. It's been gone for 30 years, but if you were a college kid growing up in the 80s, we all watched Overnight.
Yep.
It was like my
favorite
show.
It was great.
It won a DuPont Award because it was so well-written and mm-hmm. it was so well-done, and she just tells story after story, and she's one of my journalistic heroes, so I always recommend
that. And she had a tone like as distinct as Letterman.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Like there was nothing like her tone.
Very much.
Like,
exactly.
Now, Scott, other than playing through the whistle.
Is there another book?
There really isn't anything else.
I mean, I'll give you two. One is Son of the Morning Star by Evan S. Connell, which is about Custer. And could I care less about somebody. I think the story of George Armstrong Custer at Little Bighorn, I feel like I know it, and this completely explodes it. It's one of the great pieces of nonfiction ever written.
Oh, wow.
It approaches nonfiction and history in a way that I've never seen before, and the level of reporting is incredible. And then it's beautifully written. And the other one is Path to Power by Robert S. Caro, Robert Caro, which is simply the best piece of nonfiction I've ever read.
Wow, reporting. Fantastic. Wow. Raising the bar.
History is reporting.
Landslide Linden.
Yeah, Landslide Linden, exactly.
I think somebody smart said Robert Caro last week.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going with Simon the Sea Cat.
There you go, of course.
The only book to be read.
God bless you.
And Bad Blood. By John Carreyrou, I can never pronounce his name, fantastic reporter from the Wall Street Journal, wrote a book, Bad Blood, about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos, which was one of the greatest frauds of the last X years, and it is a cautionary tale about how excited we can get about technology, and fabulous book.
And I
soon to be a movie.
I think the subtitle of that book should be, There's No Fool Like an Old Fool. If you've read the book, you'll know what I mean.
I think I have that tattoo somewhere on my body. These are all excellent recommendations. I'm going to cheat a little bit. I had another book I was going to use, but then looking through the Marine Corps recommended list of reading, I'm going to go with one of my favorite books I've ever read. And I heard first that a guy named JFK said, "Wow, this is one of the finest books ever written." And it's The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman. And you talk about a nonfiction that reads like a novel. Mm-hmm. And it's just utterly compelling. And yesterday was the 100th, as we talked about, the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War. And to hear and read how it began, and she knows all the players and just writes about it so brilliantly. It's one of several unbelievably great books she read. If you ever go down that road and you start reading Barbara Tuchman, you'll be thrilled. So, but that one to me is still one of my all-time favorites.
Excellent pick for Veterans Day.
Yeah, there you go.
Excellent. Okay, wrap us up, honey.
Yes, I believe that will do it for us this week. Next week, we're going to be back in studio. Again, we tape month. You can listen to this whenever, and please tell your friends, tell your family about it. Chatter on Books. We're going to be here at Chatter And it's the restaurant owned by Anthony Irwin Kornheiser and a few other people. It's on the corner of Wisconsin Avenue and Jennifer Street.
Just inside the city line.
Yes, in Friendship Heights. We take, get here at about 4:30. We start arriving between 4:30 and 5.
Start drinking before.
Yeah, we get here at about 5:30. We start about 5:30, so we'd love to see you. We got Donna Brazile is going to be in with us next week for Thanksgiving week, so it's going to be exciting. I guess I got to think of holiday books I got to talk about then. But this is Scott. Thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah,
what a brilliant book. Playing Through the Whistle.
Thank you, Scott.
Everybody, thank you so much for another great show. And buy Simon the Sea Cat. Buy multiple copies. I'll see you guys next week.